Hello, my name is Philip Mirton, and today we are going to have a conversation beyond science and religion. First of all, to know more about me, you can visit my website at www.heavenattheendofscience.com. Now, the main theme of this show is to try to break through common beliefs and perceptions that tell us how to think about the world and ourselves. And the reason why sometimes it's good breaking through those beliefs and perceptions is that there may be something inside of us, perhaps a spiritual being, that has an unlimited potential, but we're simply not tapping that internal state of being because we've been convinced we are something else. Today I'm happy to have on the show Michael McIntosh, who himself is living his dream in Hawaii, and we're going to learn about how he wound up living his dream. Now, Mr. McIntosh is the founder of Living in Magic, Divine Abundance, and Success Ultra Now. He organizes and runs training and courses in spiritual development and living your dreams, writes articles on well-being and spirituality, leads meditation classes, and conducts gentle warrior retreats. He also does spiritual, business, and marketing advice, hypnotherapy, and records transformational meditation CDs. His mission is to help others live their highest potential with flawless ease and grace, and to help change their inner worlds, allowing the outer worlds to flourish. I want to say, before we turn to Michael, that I recently read an article he published in Veritas magazine, and I was extremely impressed by the optimism and the idealism exhibited in this article. So first of all, Michael, welcome to the show. It's nice to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you,
Dan. Now, for those who didn't hear, Michael is in Hawaii, and perhaps we could start off, Michael, by telling us a little bit about your own journey. You talk about life being a journey, which I think is hard to argue with, but why don't you tell us a little bit about your journey and how you found yourself living your dream?
That's a wonderful question. I could make this the long or the short version, but I'll give you the short version just because I've had many, many adventures on my travels through life. When I was 17, 18, I came across spiritual teachings and had some very powerful spiritual experiences which completely changed my life and really got me on a spiritual path, a very, you could say, hardcore, focused, almost ashram style, very disciplined spiritual path, which was completely the opposite of what I was doing prior. And that was great. I had many wonderful experiences, and I treasure those deeply. And just to get up to the point where I was coming to Hawaii, I didn't actually know where Hawaii was. All I knew about Hawaii, I was living in Cambridge at the time. I was living with three other guys, and we had this tiny little terraced house, very, very small, all squashed together with like five houses in a row, with these three other guys, four of us. And I didn't have enough money to pay my rent, which was about $300 or $400 a month. One of my friends was seeing my ex-girlfriend, which was very disturbing, as I'm sure you can imagine, so that I'd see them together in the house.
Right.
I wasn't doing what I wanted to do, and I was actually very, very deeply distressed, even though I had all these spiritual teachings, and I, in a sense, should have known better and didn't need to be upset. But nonetheless, I was very disturbed, extremely traumatized. I remember actually lying down in a field near my house, looking up at the sky, looking up at the clouds, and wanting to die. It was a very terrible time in my life.
Wow.
I remember looking out over the street where I lived, out of my office window, and just watching people going back and forth, and just basically wanting to leave. In fact, I kind of almost escaped in the night one time at like 2 in the morning, packed my bags and said that was it, and I actually left on the way to the airport to use my credit card trip to Thailand, because I had a friend in Thailand. And that plan was foiled at the last minute because I phoned someone up and they convinced me out of it. So that didn't work. But anyway, in my heart, I was gone, and I knew that I needed to move on. And I remember as a young, this came back to me many years later on, but I remember, you know those globes, Philip, that you can spin around, and you can actually see the Earth. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I remember saying to myself when I was a lot younger, where would be the perfect place to live? And I would spin the globe, and it would spin real fast, and I would put my finger down and stop it. And it kept hitting the middle of the Pacific Ocean. And I was like, there's nothing here. I actually didn't notice Hawaii. It just seemed like these weird nothing. And I thought, this is a huge bit of water. If you've ever looked at a globe, like there is tremendous amount of space between Hawaii and the rest of the world. In fact, this island that I'm on now, technically speaking, is the furthest away place from anywhere else in the world.
Wow, I don't think, I never realized that, but, and you're talking about Kauai?
Yeah, Kauai, this particular island, yeah. So this is as far away from the world, the rest of the world, as you can actually get.
Wow, so you are in the most remote place on the planet Earth.
That's technically, but having said that, I'm sitting here with iPhones and laptops and, you know, like chocolate machines and all sorts of crazy stuff. But it certainly doesn't feel like it, but that's actually what it is.
That's amazing.
So anyway, coming back to the pain that I was in at that time, I'm just bringing that up because of how random these things are. Like, and I remember spinning this globe a few times, and it always ended up in the middle of the ocean. And I thought, there's nothing here. This doesn't make sense. And I only realized that a few months ago. That memory came back to me. And there I was in England, didn't have any money, wasn't doing what I loved. Stuck in a house with a bunch of guys. My girlfriend was seeing my best friend in the house, and it was just like really horrible experience.
That's about the worst thing to happen. I agree with you on that.
Yeah, I mean, come on. I was in debt as well. Like, it was just, I mean, so, and I actually, we literally was asking to, like, for God to take me away or something to take me away because I was, so anyway, there got to a point where I snapped. And I realized that this can't go on anymore. This is just not acceptable way of living. I wasn't used to that degree of emotional trauma. And I was thinking, I've got all these spiritual teachings, but I haven't got any money. That doesn't make any sense, you know. Should be able to pay my bills. So I actually found this book called Creative Visualization by Shakti Gwain. You might have heard of it. And that book actually, ironically, was written on Kauai, which I found out later. So, and that book basically said, you know, just create a vision board and visualize it. So I just decided to do this. And I also read some other books about these things. Because I had lots of wonderful spiritual experiences over the years, but I hadn't manifested anything. And now I was in a mess and not manifesting things, so it was just a terrible time.
You know,
so
now,
I focused
now,
on
now one of the curious questions that comes up, you know, when we have conversations like this and someone says I had a spiritual experience, is there any one that you could share with us that perhaps isn't too personal or whatever? Because I think giving some real sort of concrete example of a spiritual experience, I think is really helpful. So maybe you could share one with us.
Sure. I've had many, and I continue to have them, and it's actually more of a way of life. But I'll give you some examples. Actually, one, when I first heard about certain spiritual knowledge, I remember actually it was my mother who shared this with me back in the day. She did meditation and she convinced me to listen to what she had to say. So I, after some reluctance, I did. And she was telling me about the soul is that we're not the body, we're actually the spiritual being, the soul, and various other things that I could go into another time. And I actually, in a sense, left my body, felt like I went beyond my body, and actually experienced myself at a cross, at a fork in the road, almost watching a vision of myself walking down a path and being at this fork. And there was, it could go down or it could go up. I had to make a decision. And I saw myself 2 years in the future in both cases. And one was just carrying on the way that I was, and the other one was choosing a spiritual life and choosing to experience happiness that is a non-physical happiness, not based on situations, but just a overflowing joy in my being. And I saw and felt, I actually experienced these two, in a sense, parallel realities.
And this was during the day.
This was during the day, just in the meditation. So she just said, you know, sit down, and I can't exactly remember what she said, but it was just, I was sitting down on a bed. She was in her bedroom with some of my friends, and we were all just sitting there, and she was had a chair, and it was just like a little bit hodgepodge, you know, informally. And this is what I was experiencing.
You know, it's really, I don't know about you, but. But one of the key elements of spiritual experiences is that they are so real to the experiencer that once you have one, nothing could talk you out of the fact that it occurred. I mean, would that be, is that a fair statement? I mean, if someone would say, well, those kinds of experiences just don't happen. I think that that's part of what we see out in a lot of the modern science literature. People like Michael Shermer, who I've mentioned on other shows, who is the publisher of the Skeptic magazine. There's others who are out there to debunk anything that sounds like it was a spiritual event. You know, maybe they'll go as far as to say there's some malady in the brain or something like that. They'll try to put it in materialistic terms. But it always strikes me when I hear a story like that, that once you have an experience, you can't talk yourself out of it. And so I could see how something like that would have a big effect on you.
Yeah. It completely actually changed the course of my life. That's how powerful that particular experience was. It made me realize I had two choices. I could carry on the way I was, or I could change things and go for something new. And that new thing, I had no idea existed until that moment. So it's almost as if a whole door, you know, this whole door with a whole world in behind the door, and like a magical door, and there's another world there that just appeared. You know, like in dreams, sometimes you walk around, you might be walking around in your house, and there's an extra door in your house that normally is not there. It was kind of like that. And since then, I've lived a completely different life. It's almost like, and in my astrology, interestingly, Vedic astrology, pinpoint exactly as a beginning of a new life. It's a complete shift in the energy of myself and you know, the stars and the planets and the whole.
Now, prior to this experience, did you take any formal training in Eastern philosophy or mysticism, or was it just a function of your reading in that area? Because the meditation, you know, has many sources, but it tends to be associated with Eastern thinking. So what was the nature of your training or education up to that time?
Well, actually, my father was a priest, a Christian priest in England. So I had obviously Christian upbringing. It didn't quite resonate with me. I didn't like dislike it, but it just somehow wasn't giving me the juice, you know, because I feel that we need to have like real meaningful, powerful experiences that give us energy.
Yes.
And I wasn't feeling that from going to church.
Yeah.
So I knew about, you know, God is good, and you know, Jesus, and you know, some of the stories in the Bible, etc., you know.
Right.
But it wasn't giving me the juice. But this meditation, which is Raj Yoga meditation. It's just extremely powerful, and I hadn't read anything about it. This is the first time I heard about this. It was when my mother was sharing. This is what she learned. You know, the soul is a point of light. God is like this. You know, this is what the reality is. So it definitely is an Eastern thought, for right. sure. But it was new to me, entirely new.
I see. Okay, so from that standpoint, you decided to embark upon a new direction, a new journey, and eventually you found yourself in Hawaii, or the place that you actually picked out on the globe.
Yeah, later on, yeah. I mean, this is kind of, we got two stories going on here. One is right at the beginning when I decided to have a spiritual life to start, and then the other one when I got to Hawaii. This was about 7 years after this event when I had this first experience.
Right.
I had 7 years of just having lots of amazing spiritual experiences. Most of the other experiences, by the way, weren't like visions of myself as a person. They're more like going beyond the sense of the body and going into a world of light, which I now understand is, in a sense, the home of this, is the place where consciousness originates from.
Now, did you, with regard to your own, I'm going to call it worldview,
mm-hmm.
Have you followed any particular thinkers or authors, or is your particular worldview sort of an amalgam of your own experiences and your own readings? Is there somebody?
Yeah.
Are there some books or authors that you would identify with? Or
well, right now.
Right. In your current worldview.
I actually have. Books, I have like bookshelves and bookshelves and bookshelves of books. I love books. I love reading. One of my favorite teachers, spiritual teachers anyway, is David Hawkins.
Okay.
His series based on power versus force and the different levels of consciousness. I found that tremendously useful. Raj Yoga teachings I found invaluable, and nothing quite of the same quality in my personal opinion. I also really enjoy a lot of the popular psychology books by people like Gay Hendricks, Jim Law, The Power of Story, those kind of books that are just dealing with, like, Maxwell Maltz's book on psycho-cybernetics. The Power of Thinking Big, that's also a great book. These kind of things. And Napoleon Hill, I love his books.
Right.
Outwitting the Devil is his latest book that was hidden for 72 years. Someone gave me a copy of that. I recommend everyone reads that. Super powerful. It was hidden because it was too controversial, so he didn't publish it.
Yeah, it's amazing that Napoleon Hill was really ahead of his time.
Oh yeah,
you know, a lot of those, and Earl Nightingale is a similar kind of writer.
Yeah.
Where they had that sort of unbridled optimism. A lot of it was, you know, I think maybe it was the media or the publishing industry tried to change it into more financial terms. You know mm-hmm. how to get rich quick. I think I have a audiobook by Napoleon Hill called, I think it's called Think and Grow Rich, but it's really not about thinking and growing rich. It's really about sort of harnessing the power of your positive mind, and it's interesting that now, and I think that's one of the things that I'm seeing in culture, is that we are shifting to a richer perspective on the power of the inner self. We're not just, it's not just little bits and pieces. We're having people like you and the authors that you mentioned giving it more and more substance.
Yeah.
So
and
go ahead.
And yeah, I mean, and to be quite frank, like, there's plenty of millionaires and billionaires around here who are my friends, you know,
right.
And they're all spiritual people. When you can talk to them about all these sort of things, in fact, you won't find many very wealthy people who don't have these kind of spiritual ideas, although they don't necessarily talk about them in a spiritual context. But when you actually get into it, they definitely understand the power of their mind. They definitely understand the power of intention, and these are all spiritual principles, you know.
Now why do you think that these successful people have this spiritual side to them?
Because, I mean, this is my personal opinion. I feel, and from all of my readings, that really it's not that we have a spiritual side, it's that we are spiritual beings. We are non-physical consciousness. And these people who are, you know, conscious beings inhabiting a body or experiencing a human life, they know that they're not the body. And I can talk to them about this kind of stuff that we're sharing, and they know exactly what I'm saying. And they say, yeah, of course, I know I'm not the body. I know I don't own anything. I know I haven't got anything. I know I'm just here temporarily. And I know that the power of my mind is affecting the world. I know these basic things, which are spiritual, but it's just almost matter of fact, more than it's this esoteric woo-woo thing that you need scientific.
That's really interesting, because, you know, my own little mission, or my own specialty, is the other side of the argument to what I call material science or scientific materialism, where many leading thinkers, if not the thought leaders for science, are hardcore materialists. And there is one image that comes from one of the Richard Dawkins books, which he calls people robot vehicles. And that's an image that I think we might agree is exactly opposite to a spiritual being. You know, the concept of a robot vehicle to me is something that is imprisoned within a metallic structure, and so that you are always limited by your container, by your equipment, or by your outer being. And I think it's very interesting that these successful people who live down there or out there and are friends of yours realize that to be really successful, you can't be limited.
No.
Right, and that comes across in your article, and I'm sure in other of your teachings and writings about that old adage, don't limit yourself or don't doubt yourself. So that's really an important point, I think. With regard to, just let's be clear a little bit, because the term spiritual is used a lot, and, you know, it could be sort of religious, it could be some kind of ephemeral thought. How do you describe what spirituality or spiritual? What do you mean by that term?
How I understand it, how I feel it, is if we look at our life, just anyone can just imagine this, that here we are, we're having right now, what is going on right now? Right now we have, you're hearing words through your ears, you know, there's sounds coming in, and that they're being going into your brain and being translated in your mind as words, and hopefully some of this is being understood. One doesn't speak English, they won't understand it. It just sounds like a bunch of noises. And then we've got our physical experience, which includes, you know, blood pumping through the body and the different organs and how we're feeling emotionally. You know, so there's, what is life? It's a series of experiences on many levels. I'm in Hawaii, I can see the blue skies, there's beautiful breeze, there's coconut trees, I've got this lovely office, you know. So there's different experiences that we're having, physical experience, mental experience with our mind, emotional experience. And then I would say this spiritual experience is the thing that contains, that has all of those other things contained within it. And so I often ask people to think about this, that when you say, for example, you point at the moon, imagine there's a full moon and you're pointing up at the moon, where are you seeing the moon?
That's interesting.
Where is it? It's in your mind, really.
Right.
That's what's experiencing it, which is inside of you.
Right.
So how I define spirituality, or the word spiritual, is that there is this thing, which you can call it spirit, soul, consciousness, you know, there's many different terms, energy, awareness, there's, you know, you different books, different people have different words, but there's something, a very big, important, fundamental, primary thing, whatever you want to call it, that has contained within it all of the other things. Because how do we even know we're alive? How do we even know that we're having an experience? There's got to be something going on basic to everything else. There's got to be a foundation we can then build on, you know? So we're having a conversation right now.
Right.
But how are we having this conversation? We're obviously aware that we exist, and we're aware that we're talking to each other. So who is it? Who is it, or what is it? This thing that is aware that we're having a conversation, that we've got things to do, and that we've got emails, and, you know, who is this being? And I've read so many books. Like, there's a great book called Holographic Universe by Michael Tolbert, excellent book, that has cases and cases and cases of people who have left their bodies because of having car accidents and being when they're operated on, who leave their body, go into another room, see what happened in another room, come back, and then talk to tell what happened. And this has been done scientifically, and they've tested this. And in fact, one of the people who's on our train, Gerald O'Donnell, he was the remote viewer for the CIA and the American government, as a spy, his body going into various places and going back and telling them what he saw as a job, you know. So that thing that is going beyond, that exists beyond the body, that has feelings, that has thoughts, that has sensations, that thing is what I consider spiritual.
And and I would agree. I think the Holographic Universe is a good book, and I have that myself. I think the way you put it, where you named a lot of terms such as soul, energy, consciousness, mind. One of the things that I think is important is that because reductionism tends to guide our scientific minds, where we want to reduce the big to the small, and we want to have categories and file things away, we tend to forget that if the early mystics were right and the world is one, then when we use different terms, we're really just calling the same thing different words.
Yeah.
And I tend, you know, after thinking about it, my most simplistic way of looking at it is I like to call it the inner and the outer. Now, I'm like you. I think that mind, consciousness, awareness, spirit, energy, soul, those all different terms, but it's not as if there's a different compartment inside of us that is called the soul and something else called the consciousness. It's maybe it's the mood you're in, but I like the inner and the outer just because when I talk about what's inside of us, I like to tell people, you know, close your eyes and concentrate on the interior experience and what you feel inside is the power of the of spirit, or the power of your inner being. Now, I'm not a meditator. You could probably do a lot better job describing that inner experience than I can. But I like to say that that the inner power is the within, and then the physical world in three-dimensional space is the outer. And I also my own belief is that the outer is a reflection of the inner. It's as simple as that. And it's not, it doesn't get any more complicated. And I'm not the only one that ever said that. There's plenty of people, such as George Berkeley, Immanuel Kant had something like that. And of course, there's all sorts of Eastern philosophers who have a similar viewpoint. And I think that your own perspective is really, it's encouraging, because we're starting to see more and more intelligent people realize that materialism isn't the end all. And in fact, in my own opinion, it's not true. So what I in your experience, in many of the in your classes or your clients, what have you found to be the major impediments to getting your message across?
Well, you know, one of the things that I find just in general is the degree of miscommunication that we have to deal with on a basis. Everyone, all of us, you know,
right.
There's people just have different meanings for different words based on the context and where they used them before. So the fact, if anyone, you know, can understand something that's been said and it's the same as what the person meant, that's a miracle. But we assume that everything we say is completely understood by somebody, but it isn't, you know. So just knowing that has been very useful to me, not assuming that people understand things as they were intended. To be honest with you, the people who come to work with me, and there's thousands and thousands of people I've worked with, they already know from their own personal experience that they are spiritual beings. And so that hasn't been an issue for me to deal with, because, you know, we like attracts like, in a way. So they basically know that materialism didn't work for them, and they're feeling depressed or upset, and they want something more. They want some more meaning. They want some more juice. They want the real juicy, wonderful experiences of happiness and inner joy and satisfaction. They're not getting it from the buying bunch of stuff. So they want something else. That's why they've come in the first place.
Yeah.
So what are the issues? I think one of the things, probably the biggest thing, is that people don't realize they have to practice these things very consistently. That, and a lot of people, they learn information like, okay, I'm a spiritual being, or I'm consciousness, or my mind is powerful. They learn something, but they don't apply it in their life practically. You know, it's kind of as if there's these two compartments in someone's mind.
Yeah.
Or that says, okay, if I'm learning the piano, I know I need to practice scales and learn how to read and everything. But if I'm doing spiritual stuff, that somehow is a different category entirely. And I don't need to really do anything. And that, I think, is the biggest problem. So my aim is to say, look, you've got to practice this stuff. The law of attraction and the secret, everyone, most people have either heard about the law of attraction or they've watched The Secret since it came out. It's very popular. So people read, then they know that if I hold the vision of something in my mind and I want to achieve it, then it's going to come to me. And this has been my experience again and again and again. Even actually this interview, I was saying I need to do more interviews. I'm ready to do more interviews.
Right.
And down on a piece of paper. And you emailed me about a week later, right?
Yeah, that's interesting.
Now, I didn't know.
Yeah.
You didn't know that either. But this, I just wrote it down on a piece of paper. I had the vision for that to happen. And I didn't know how it was going to happen, but you called me. I was, another example is I was listening to this audio about manifestation by Kevin Trudeau, who we interviewed recently. And he, on one of his audios, he talks about if you want to manifest a new car and you're thinking black Mercedes, black Mercedes, black Mercedes, and he kept saying this. And I was actually realized afterwards while I was driving my new black Mercedes that's what he said. Someone gave me a black Mercedes.
That's amazing.
They gave it to me. They left the island and they said, here you go, you can have it.
Yeah.
So I was driving. I would never have thought of a black Mercedes, but that had gone in my psyche, and not just a Mercedes, a black, you know. So, but the thing is, I practice what I preach. I'm a very focused person. So, the biggest impediment, the biggest thing is people put it in the wrong category, and they say,
yeah,
it's all this weird woo-woo abstract stuff. They don't have to do anything. But no, consider it to be like learning the piano. And then you can use it and get a result with it. It's very, very, very practical. I actually rely on this stuff for, you know, and I teach, mainly what I teach is people business stuff using these principles. And it works really amazingly well, you know.
You mean the intentionality, the visualization?
Yeah.
The focusing on results. Yeah, you know, it's funny because I'm in the business world as well. A lot, and there's quite an overlap. When you read the serious business books, they do the same thing. They cloak it in different words, and it sounds more scientific.
Yeah.
But simple things like vision statements, or goals.
Yeah.
You know, why do you bother writing a vision statement? You know, major corporations, writing out their goals for the year, it focuses the energy of the company upon
mm-hmm.
these goals, and of course they do. You know, they probably are much more regimented in tracking progress, etc. But I think that it's wider spread than maybe we let it out to be. The other thing that I would say here, it's amazing to me, is that synchronicity,
mm-hmm.
which you mentioned a couple there. Every time I raise the topic to people, they always say, oh yeah, something weird happened to me, or this happened to me, or some, you know, I was thinking about a friend and she called, or I was humming a song and the guy next to me started humming the same song, or, you know, just strange things. It's amazing, the undertone, to the world. A lot of times we just don't recognize it. And maybe,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's sort of something maybe you're saying. Now, I want to go to this one point, because the last couple shows I've had Richard Smalley, who's a leading mystical philosopher, and last week we spoke to Bruce Rosenblum, who's a quantum physicist, and I asked them both about whether they ever thought that consciousness would be part of science. And surprisingly, they both said yes, but not in their lifetimes. Now, I'm just wondering, from your perspective, where you clearly know that what you're teaching and your own ideas are sort of contrary to the scientific worldview. And I'm just wondering what your response is to those who say, oh, it's all this mystical, gobbledygook. It doesn't really mean anything. What's your response to critics? Assuming you have any critics, but what is your
mm-hmm.
response to criticism that you're going against the grain of modern science?
Well, first thing I would say to someone who's actually serious about that inquiry, you know, so anyone can make a criticism, you know, half-heartedly, but if they're actually serious and they really want to prove their point and, you know, have a good look at it, I would say there's a wonderful book called Punk Science. I don't remember the author now. Punk Science, that goes through the history very clearly, and basically, really, with quantum physics, they're having to acknowledge consciousness as a factor in the reality of things and how it's affecting things. I mean, right. That's what quantum physics does, as well as other things.
Right.
So I don't actually think, in all honesty, that what these things are contrary to modern science, like real modern science. They're contrary to, you know, Newtonian physics, sure, but that's hardly modern science anymore. You know, this is a long time ago. I come from Cambridge, you know, Cambridge University. Right. You know, Sir Isaac Newton,
right.
I think the drop, yeah, you know, yeah, he came from Cambridge. The apple was there in Cambridge. I know yeah. lots of these people, yeah?
Yeah, that's
so,
good.
You know, we've moved on a long way since Newton's days, and quantum physics has proven a lot. And that really, there's plenty of scientists who are absolutely fascinated by consciousness and mysticism and study it, you know, because they want to know what's going on. And science originally was the search of truth, you know. It wasn't like they were separated between, you know, like the physical and the non-physical. The church and science was kind of divided in two at some point. But, you know, to its root, science is interested in truth, not interested in... if you're interested in truth, then you need to be interested in truth, not interested in proving a position.
Yeah,
that you have. That's why I would say to people is like, scientists say that they're into being, that they're objective, but they have a very strong point to prove, which kind of doesn't align up very well.
Yeah,
that's what I've noticed.
Yeah, that's. I mean, right now the way I look at it is, or one perspective on the situation is that we still have science divided from spirituality or religion or philosophy. I mean, you could put all those softer sciences to the side. We still go into one classroom for science, and people go to a church, a synagogue, maybe a classroom for their spiritual fulfillment. I think, I'm wondering what your view is on whether at some point we'll go to one place. In other words, science will be united with spirituality. That it'll be a science of spirituality or some other title. Do you think that is something that's going to happen, or do you think there's always going to be like a dividing line between them?
No, I think it's already happening, and it's destined to happen. That would be my response. That one thing to be aware of that David Hawkins talks about in his books is that the domain of science is, you know, primarily dealing with a linear model of, you know, this causes that.
Right.
And in science, there's an expression, non-linear dynamics, which is kind of showing that there's connections that go beyond what we're used to thinking makes sense, like start and stop, that you can actually have one thing affect something on the other side of the universe without them actually technically being connected. And there's all sorts of weird, wacky stuff in science when you start reading into it that kind of really sounds pretty much the same as like the Vedas and the Indian scriptures a lot of the time, you know?
So I
think it's already that way inclined, but it's hard to, I think the limit of science is that we can't measure spiritual subjective experiences using certain scientific methodology, and so where it starts getting confusing. But if we realize that there's certain things that can't be measured in a particular way, it's like I can't see the Wi-Fi signals right now. Oh, I can't pick them up whatsoever. Computer is,
right.
You know.
Yeah.
But and it does exist, but my measurement of my body doesn't register it. So we need to have a different way of measuring, a different way of calculating things that can accommodate for different realities.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, I subscribe to Scientific American, and it's a very good magazine to obviously keep yourself up to date on the developments in science. But it's amazing. Some of the theories that are front page news or that are leading the charge right now in science are starting to sound more and more mystical. You know, the multiverse is one where based upon various versions of string theory or quantum fluctuations or the eternal return, all sorts of different theories, they're dreaming up the possibility that there might be an infinite number of universes out there. And a recent Scientific American article said, well, that's fine, but it's beyond the proof of science. You know, by definition, we can't prove these things. And so it leads to the question of, well, what makes the multiverse science and spirituality the supernatural? There's so little difference between them in terms of proof. And well, let me rephrase that. One, we could prove because we have the spiritual experiences, like you said earlier. The other one, multiverse, we'll never prove. So that maybe this is the same issue in your recent article in Veritas. You talk about the old paradigm and the new paradigm. And then you talk about the land of the death and the golden age. Is this the same topic, or maybe you could elucidate on those concepts?
So if we go back in history, throughout history, and even now if you go around the world, you'll see that people have different perceptions, different belief systems, different cultures. I mean, it's obvious to anyone, and you can prove it through science, that there's people who think they do different things every day. And if you talk to them, you find out, think a different way. We go to someone in Israel, they think a particular way about certain things, and we think differently, and that's fine. You know, everyone in Africa, the tribal people, they don't know anything about you know, technology, because if they're Bushmen, they don't know what a computer even is, they've never seen one. So there's different kinds of people, different realities. And I think what's happening in the world right now is that we're going through a death, a destruction of an old system. And primarily this old system comes from the Industrial Revolution, where we started creating factories, you know, and that whole mentality of just like making things as much as possible, as cheap as possible, uniform, and treat people like machines, basically, you know.
Right.
And now what's happening, because we've created abundance, and you know, everyone can have their own lifestyle, do what they want, and they can buy weird things and have, you know, there's choice now that wasn't available before. And also most work is not, they're not factory people, they're in offices having to figure things out using their brain, you know.
Right.
So this has allowed for just a huge expansion of thoughts and ideas, and the internet is just this massive amount of information. Apparently more information is created every 2 days on the internet than was in the history. So this is just a huge thing. So with all this massive change that's happening, we're realizing that we don't have to live in the way that we used to. And people are starting to question what is important, what is really meaningful. And a lot of people who have previously been going to work with a job and hating their job, hating their life, they've lost their job. And on one hand, that's a terrible thing, got the money that they wanted. But on the other hand, they're liberated from doing something they hate for 8 hours a day or 10 hours a day. And there's so many factors, like meditation 10 years ago was a weird thing. Now lots of people have heard about meditation. Yoga was a really weird thing not so long ago. Now people go to yoga classes all over the country. It's quite common. It's in magazines. Oprah is now talking about all kinds of spiritual stuff all the time.
Right.
It's a big shift is happening. People are realizing that there's more to life, that they've got a choice. And in the Indian, well, not necessarily Indian, but ancient mystical understanding of time, there is something known as Sat Yuga, which means the age of truth or the age of enlightenment. And then there is also something called Kal Yuga, which means the age of death, of untimely death, the age of darkness. From that point of view, it could be said that we're shifting from the dark night into the dawn, right? Because people are waking up, they're letting go of things that don't work for them, their level of integrity is increasing, people are thinking for themselves, they're tuning into that inside world that you were talking about, inside. And as people really refine their the inside world, I mean, think about how many books there are on self-help nowadays. Right. You know, there's a huge self-help is the biggest section in the bookshops, the growing section, because people really want to improve themselves. So the effect of all this self-change, improvement, people waking up and wanting to change things, is changing the way they live, changing the way that the world operates, and I feel it's moving into a more enlightened way of doing things. Why should we have to slave away like a bunch of machines when we don't need to anymore? You know, why should we eat a bunch of junk food that makes us sick when there's other alternatives? So this is the shift, and there's, of course, levels of that shift. Some people are having amazing lives, and other people are kind of just improving a little bit. But it's still an upward movement.
Yeah, I would agree. It's interesting to compare the current age with the original Enlightenment. Mm-hmm. The original Enlightenment, to me, one of the important descriptions of what it meant is what Immanuel Kant said. He said it was the time when man started thinking for himself, started using his reasoning power instead of being controlled by the dictates of orthodox organized religion, essentially, or by mm-hmm. kings and queens. And it seems to me that we might be in a new enlightenment. That's sort of what, I mean, in your article, you used the word Great Awakening, and, mm-hmm. and there's other people that are using the same term, and it's sort of like what we talked about with different names for the same thing, different, you know, soul, spirit, etc. We could all be talking about the same thing, which is recognizing the power of the inner self or the inner spirit. It's something I definitely agree with, and one of the key elements here is the momentum, and I think you also talk about momentum. I mean, the way I like to look at it is maybe we call it critical mass, gaining a foothold, but there has to be some point in time where the old systems really do crumble, right? I mean, is that what you think as well?
I think it's not sustainable. I mean, look at the economy. The economy is in a total mess. Right. You know, America is in trillions of, was it now, $16 trillion debt? Is it 16? I mean, it keeps going up.
Yes.
It's out of control.
Yes.
And why is it in so much debt? Well, you could come up with many reasons why. I think one of the big reasons is that people have not been doing what they enjoy doing and have not been really adding value. You know, because like wealth is created by an exchange of value. And if you've got people hating what they do every day, how can that be the real value if they were doing what they're really good at and discovering that their potential and really do that to the world? That would be far more valuable, you know. And this is a lot of what I do when I work with clients. So I help them see what value they can offer and how to add maximum value. And that's how we create wealth. That's how I've created wealth for myself. Yeah. And so I think the Great Awakening is people that they want more. They realize that basically there's only so much ice cream you can eat before you get sick. You know.
Yes.
There's only so many shoes you have till your cupboard's full, and you realize that it didn't work. The people know. Everyone knows. It's nothing. Everyone knows that after you buy something, after 2-3 days, doesn't have that happiness feeling that it did when you bought it. We know this. We can't lie to ourselves. There's studies on the the last length of things make us happy for. So people know, okay, I've got everything I ever wanted, and I'm still depressed. What else is there? So this is why people are waking up and are realizing that it's adding value to others. It's nourishing themselves on the inner world and on the outer world together. These things that really bring joy. And of course, just as if you improve a system, like if you upgrade your operating system from, you know, like Windows, you know, 98, and you know to something else, you know, you have to actually erase the other one. You overwrite it.
Right.
You know, and that's basically what's happening is, you know, no one's using VHRs anymore. You know, no one uses Betamax anymore. We don't use tapes anymore. We don't even use CDs anymore, hardly, you know.
Right. Yes.
Everything's now iPods and downloadable things. Bookshops have been replaced by Amazon. So, you know, we have to get with the program and realize that things are changing. And those people who are holding on to the old systems, you know.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, what we're talking about is really a new world where people waking up to their true selves, and you call it that we're really extremely powerful, immortal, spiritual beings. Now, this may be maybe partly just unbridled optimism. Maybe there is some mysticism involved in it, but it seems to me that the tidal wave is gaining power. Who knows when we could actually get there. I'd like to thank you, Michael, for your time today. It was very enlightening. And maybe you could just tell the listeners how to get a hold of you, your website, perhaps.
Yeah, you can go to www.livinginmagic.com or livinginmagic.com or michaelmackintosh.com.
And thank you very much. And I hope you all realize that the only way you get to where Michael is and where maybe the two of us think we need to go is by breaking through the perceptions, the beliefs that have constrained us, that have prevented us from realizing our true potential. This is Philip Mirotin. My website is heavenattheendofscience.com. Thank you for listening. And Michael, thank you very much for your time. It's been very enjoyable.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.